located at 3105 Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley. For more information, call 510-595-5555 or visit www.livingartsplayback.com. This event is a benefit for the Living Arts Center.
And you're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KSCF in Fresno, online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned for Open Book with Richard Wolinski.
Try the other one. Ah, nope. Nothing like KPFA. There we go. I'm Richard Wolinski. My guest calling from New York is Tony Kushner. Tony Kushner is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Angels in America. He's also a screenwriter for both Lincoln and Munich, author of several other works, the most recent of which is The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures, otherwise known as IHO, which is playing at Berkeley Rep through June 29th, and we're live on the air. Tony, you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi. Great talking with you. Let me start by asking about the origins of IHO. It's the story of a retired longshoreman, a leftist retired longshoreman, and his three members of his family. And I guess it's your big family play. Going back a bit, what prompted you to focus in on Gus and his family? What got you started on the story of IHO?
Well, he's not just a leftist. He's actually a member of the CPUSA. He's a communist. And, he's a member of an Italian-American family in Brooklyn that has a long, radical left tradition going back to, anarchism at the turn of the 20th century. So he's in the family business in a way of being directly involved in sort of radical and revolutionary political activity. There are a number of different things that brought the play about. I mean, for one thing, the title,
which is from Shaw,
yes, and then with a little bit extra borrowed from Mary Baker Eddy and the Guide to Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. So it's Christian Science and Shaw combined. I have been obsessed with the title of the Shaw book, which is The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism and Capitalism, for many years, since I first found the book by Shaw with that title on my grandmother's library shelf. I decided that I wanted to write a play with that as the title before I knew what the play was going to be. And then I began to think of different possibilities. And it was around this time that the Teamsters Local 1, the stagehands union in New York, was going on strike. And I was surprised to discover in the New York theatrical community a large number of people who were had become or have always been rather vocally anti-union. I got involved in a number of heated exchanges with some of my colleagues about the things that are, as far as I'm concerned, kind of foregone conclusions and fundamental assumptions that we've made as a civilization about people's right to be employed, people not being dispensable or disposable, people creating wealth by working and consequently having some right to a share in the wealth that they create, and just a sort of a fundamental belief in the principle of workers' rights to organize to guarantee, among other things, I mean, a decent wage, but also some kind of job security. And it made me think a lot about how much has changed in the last 30 years or so since the Reagan revolution, counter-revolution began, which, of course, notoriously began with the destruction of American unions, starting with the air traffic controllers. And I thought it was probably an interesting time to start to think about organized labor and its relationship to the left and to political radicalism. I lived for 13 years in Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn, fairly near the Brooklyn waterfront, and in an Italian-American neighborhood. I've been editing Arthur Miller's plays for Library of America, so I've spent a lot of time reading Arthur Miller. Work, and I've always loved View from the Bridge. So all those things sort of came together, I think, and made me decide that I wanted to write about an Italian-American family living in Brooklyn in some way involved in both sort of revolutionary political activity and organized labor. And that's sort of where the play originated.
And then you focus in on the three children, one of whom is a bisexual, mostly lesbian woman, who's, I believe, she's an attorney, I think?
She's a labor lawyer.
Yeah, yeah. And a gay son and a kind of right-wing carpenter son. And
not right-wing. He's totally
He's kind of
liberal.
Nothing, yeah.
But he's not. I mean, he seems somewhat conservative compared to
the
rest of his family.
And so you begin to develop them. I've talked to a number of writers about how they find voices, the voice of the characters. How did you find these? Did Gus or did any of the kids just come automatically to you? What was that process like?
It's never really automatic. Sometimes you write for a specific actor, and that helps. The part of Pill, the gay son, was written for Steven Spinella, for whom I wrote the part of Prior Walter in Angels in America. The part of Empty was written for Linda Emond, who sort of created the role of the homebody in Homebody Kabul in my play about Afghanistan a number of years ago. And somebody I love and always love working with. You know a certain actor's voice and their strengths and their cadences and the ways in which they're funny or sexy on stage, and that helps shape the character. And sometimes the character sort of emerges from a fragment of somebody you noticed on the subway talking. As I said, I lived in Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn for a number of years, and in the apartment building that I lived in, everybody else in the building was Italian-American working class. So I spent a lot of time listening to people talking back then, and I've always loved that particular kind of dialect and lingo. It's I enjoyed living in Carroll Gardens for the time that I lived there. So characters sort of assembled themselves from fragments, and they're complicated people. So they're both working class, at least Gus, the father, is working class, but also somebody who is fluent in Marxist-Leninist political doctrine, and has in the years he's actually been part of a strike in the early 70s in which the ILU, the International Longshoremen's Union in Brooklyn, won for its senior members a guaranteed annual income. So he hasn't had to work much in the last 30 years, and he's one of the things that he's done is to teach himself Latin and to start translating Horace, the Roman poet Horace. So he's a very intelligent and eloquent guy, and also a working class guy. And as you begin to figure out who these people are, you begin to hear what they sound like, the choices of words that we make, and the kinds of jokes that we make, and the way we sound angry or sad is, of course, entirely determined by who we want to be perceived as being, who we actually are, what we're after. And that's sort of the fun of writing a play.
Well, the story pivots on his deciding that there's no point in going on. He's going to kill himself, and he calls his children in there. At what point in the development was that kind of like the trigger that started it all, or did that come later after you had the characters?
I think there was an idea from fairly early on in the process of coming up with the play that Gus was suicidal. I didn't sort of realize it until I had written the first draft of the play. My father, who died 2 years ago, was diagnosed with kidney disease about 7 years ago. And so when I started working on Iho, which was like 2 years into his diagnosis, we could tell that things were going in a bad direction and that we were going to lose him sometime within the next few years. And I think in a way the play anticipates the loss of him. He's nothing like Gus. He did have two sons and a daughter, but none of us are anything like the characters
right.
in the play. I'm not even sure that he liked the play all that much when he read it. He was a little horrified by some of it, but I think it was a way of dealing with you know, what was going to be a very difficult loss for me, and sometimes that's what you do when you write, and I didn't know that I was doing it at the time. I became interested in the question of what suicide would mean to someone who was so future-oriented and so completely communally and community-oriented, and I began reading around and discovered there's a sort of an interesting sub-history of Marxists who committed suicide. Some of them very famous, and there's some very famous incidents, including Bolsheviks who did it. And I became sort of fascinated with the contradictions in that, and also with a certain kind of consonance that I began to imagine might exist between, or I was at least curious about whether or not there was a connection between a politics predicated on revolution and the decision to take control of your own life by ending it. I think part of the work on the play, it's been a long time that I've spent on it, has been to puzzle my way through that.
When you're doing that, I know I talk to a number of novelists, and sometimes the novel changes the person and sometimes it doesn't. For you, Tony Kushner, as a playwright, do each of these plays change you as you grapple with these issues, you think?
I think they certainly have an effect on me. I don't know if they change me necessarily. I mean, you know, certainly Angels in America changed me because it changed
right.
my life in a kind of outrageous way, but you know, you put an enormous amount of yourself into a play, and I tend to work on my plays for several years before there's a first draft, and then I kind of rewrite them and play with them and pull them apart and put them back together again for several years after. Intelligent Homosexual was done first at the Guthrie in 2009, and it's had a production in New York since then, and then this is its third production, and I've been taking it out and playing with it in the time in between those productions. So there's a great deal of you that goes into anything that you really create and love and are obsessed with. And there was no play like this before, and now there is this play, and it alters the landscape of your life. Whether or not it fundamentally changed me, I mean, I wouldn't say that it has. But, you know, you feel like, okay, so I did that, and I've learned things, I've done things in this play that I couldn't have done 10 years ago that I didn't know how to do. And that's exciting to me. It's a way of marking changes that have happened in me. But I'm not sure that it's really altered me. Maybe the only thing that I've written that really changed the way that I thought in the process of writing it was the Lincoln screenplay, which I worked on for 7 years and had a kind of a ground shifting effect on my politics.
How so?
Well, I mean, because Lincoln was a progressive centrist politician who had, you know, this absolutely bone marrow deep faith in democracy, and who because of his absolutely miraculous grasp of the machinery of democracy was able to work within the law and within the parameters of a constitutional republic, even at a time of horrendous crisis, and continue to advance human society and to make progress and to make even a revolutionary transformation, help make a revolutionary transformation in human society. I mean, at terrible cost. But I think partly just reading as much as I read about Lincoln and also doing the work on the screenplay. I mean, I started in 2005, so it began in the Bush years, in the nightmare of the Bush years. But by end of 2008, I was working on Lincoln during the Obama presidency. And we were out of filming, I think, in 2010, right? So that was an incredible blessing for me. It was a chance to see a president who, whether or not he's as great as Abraham Lincoln, I don't know, but who is, I think, a very great president and a great politician and a great political leader, tackling another vast national crisis and, in my opinion, doing a brilliant job, and I think a salvational kind of job for the country. It shifted my politics. It made me start to ask questions about, I mean, I consider myself a person of the left, but I have become increasingly concerned about a possible comfort that the left in this country has come to feel with powerlessness, and the kind of freedom to adhere purely to your political convictions if you actually don't have access to power and have to make the kind of compromises necessary to exercise power in a democracy. And so the prism of Lincoln made me think about things in a rather different way. I think that's an I-ho. I mean, the big central dialectic in the play is between Gus and his daughter Empty about the question of evolutionary versus revolutionary change. And you know, I don't think this is a simple question, and I hope I haven't presented any kind of simple answers in the play. But it's something that I think Lincoln helped me identify and think more seriously about.
You're listening to an interview with Tony Kushner, whose play, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with the Key to the Scriptures, plays through June 29th at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley. You know, when I'm hearing you, my feeling about Obama being on the left is great disappointment, assuming that I expected anything more from, you know, someone who lives in, you know, a world where he brings in people like Timothy Geithner to control the economics. And then I go back to your play, and I'm thinking about Gus and his decision to commit suicide, and, you know, it gives me pause because he wants to kill himself because he doesn't see any forward motion. And his view of what's going on in society is very similar to a lot of people on the left. You know, it's like overwhelming. The economics of Wall Street have seemed to have left us dispossessed.
Well, you know, I mean, I disagree with you. I mean, I'm sorry that you feel nothing but disappointment. I'm sort of astonished by that, honestly. I don't get it. I don't understand, first of all, the short-term memory issue, because we've gone through 8 years of the most appalling criminal misconduct in a presidential administration that really brought the world, I think, to the brink and maybe over the brink, we don't know yet. The Bush administration was an absolute catastrophe in every way. If really what you've seen in the last 6 years of Obama's presidency is nothing but a source of disappointment, it's probably a longer conversation, but I don't understand it. I don't understand this despair. I think Timothy Geithner is certainly somebody about whom it's possible to have many negative feelings, but I also think that there was an absolutely serious attempt at fiscal reform, within the givens that a president in our country at this particular moment in its historical development has to deal with, and I think that there's been a kind of economic recovery, and we have a pretty decent shot at, and we have health care reform now. I mean, I think he's done some extraordinary things. I think that the new,
keep in mind that I would vote for him again, but that may have more to do with the fact that, holding the fort, against the Koch brothers and the extremists on the right, and
yeah, but you're somebody who has access to a public forum, and so while I'll vote for him again, isn't really, we may lose the Senate in this next election cycle, and that's a really terrifying thing. We've lost so much time. The Congress has become completely paralyzed, not because of Obama or because of Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid. Whatever you think of people like Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, these are people who are at least committed to the idea of government and of some form of communal action to address human problems, as opposed to the incredible crazy people on the right who have taken control of the Republican Party and are absolutely determined to, bring any semblance of functioning government to a halt. And we've lost decades to these people on issues like climate change, and we can't afford to lose any more time. And that it's so important that we express our disappointment and that we, say, well, we'll vote for him, but he, Timothy Geithner, and we'll vote for him, but Larry, it's like, okay, but, first of all, extraordinary gains in the last 6 years, and a serious commitment to lessening climate warming gases. I mean, there's much that has been accomplished after 30 years of shocking misrule, and it doesn't happen overnight. And I just feel that we're so sort of willing to sit back and kvetch, but it's not enough to just say, well, we'll certainly vote for him again, but we're not helping to build the kind of Congress, the kind of federal government that will respond to grassroots demands for a better world, for a more decent world. And if we don't have anyone in Congress who can hear us, we're not going to get things like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and, the Wagner. I mean, those things are not going to happen. And I think we've become incredibly sort of blasé about sort of shrugging our shoulders about it. So I'm not saying that you, Richard, are shrugging your shoulders, but it's a great source of frustration I don't understand it. I think it's we're in so much trouble, and we have to figure out a way to address the terrible dangers that the whole planet is facing now, and we're not going to do it if we allow these madmen to continue to control at least one-third, arguably two-thirds, of the federal government. We've got to turn it around. And
Tony Kushner, in that regard, I wanted to talk about theater, but You did make a comment that I read in an interview. You said there's a kind of optimism in Angels in America that is a lot harder to come by these days. And it seems to me from what you're talking about, you know, I buy that comment, right? I'm feeling that way. I'm not feeling Gus-like because, you know.
Good.
You know, I'm not feeling that way, but I know a lot of people who are. And you know, it's great to hear somebody say, well, let's be optimistic. But I think when you create a character like Gus and you yourself say it's harder to be optimistic as we grow older and we see what's going on, you know, it's difficult. I think one of the things that theater does, though, is it allows us in, and maybe you can comment on this, to explore these issues in ways that even an interview or a documentary or even a film can't do. What do you think about that?
I mean, you know, I think that when I made that remark to the interviewer about the difference between Angels and Iho in terms of optimism and pessimism, you know, I mean, when I wrote Angels in 1988, I remember thinking when I started putting in all this stuff about the ozone layer, it felt to me, I thought, well, what if this is actually proven to be, you know, nonsense? I mean, I've written this play that everybody's going to roll their eyes at because, you know, what if there really isn't any kind of danger to the environment? And what if I'm just, you know, believing the wrong people? Because it seemed, even then, in 1988, somewhat, you know, far-fetched. But I had read enough to believe that it probably wasn't and that I should, you know, include it in the play and write about it. And, of course, lamentably, it turned out to be, you know, pretty much on the money. And so now when you listen to Angels in 2014, you hear the climate change stuff in the play. It used to be sort of a minor chord sounding sort of in the background. It's now actually painful to listen to, I think. And there has never been anything that the human race has faced, including the nuclear proliferation, as terrifying as what we're facing in terms of you know, the ecocide that we're committing, and it is completely paralyzing, and paralysis produces despair and asks us to question whether or not it's even worth it being alive. I've always felt that you know, sort of hope is not a feeling state, it's a choice, and it's in its way a moral obligation, that if you have the possibility of hoping, you have to examine your circumstances and look around for plausible occasions whence hope might arise. That's one of the things that your privilege is by you, is the ability, the opportunity, the breathing space to do that. And you know, sometimes it's very hard to discern plausible occasions for hope, but rarely absolutely entirely impossible. And I'm not saying lie to yourself. I mean, you have to make it what Ernst Bloch called, you know, concrete knowing hope, hope that you've really passed through a very strong set of tests, hope that actually means something. But I think that, you know, that's our job. That's what we're meant to do. I think that, you know, interviews, essays, films, theater, all of these things can produce that. You know, there's always the example of, you know, King Lear. I mean, there are
Tony.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, we've run out of time.
Okay. All right.
No, that's great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with the Key to the Scriptures plays through June 29th at Berkeley Rep. For more information, you could go to berkeleyrep.org. Thank you, Tony Kushner, for being on Open Book. Tomorrow on my Book Waves program, an interview with novelist Susan Minot. I'm Richard Walensky for Open Book.
Over the past 30 years, a new systemic conception of life has emerged in the forefront of science. Fritjof Capra can describe it. Physicist and systems theorist, founding director of the Center for Eco-Literacy, author of The Tao of Physics, The Hidden Connections, Belonging to the Universe, Capra has won many prestigious awards, including the Bioneers. He will discuss his major new work, The Systems View of Life, A Unifying Vision, on Thursday, June 26th at St. John's Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley.